Welcome to The Lead, the New Lines Magazine podcast. I'm Faisal Yafai, and this is a podcast where we delve into the biggest ideas, events, and personalities from around the world. Few countries are more politicized than Lebanon. Within living memory, the country has endured civil war, assassinations of its prime minister and top officials, a nationwide anti-government protest movement, the 2020 Beirut port explosion that devastated the capital city, and most recently, the conflict in Gaza that has also claimed the lives of dozens of civilians on Lebanon's southern border. Lebanon's citizens, whether they choose to or not, live in the political firing line. In such conditions, almost everyone is forced to contend with the daily reality of politics. What it means and how it might affect you has real life or even death consequences. My guest today has also dedicated herself to living a political life, but she has only briefly dabbled in a career in mainstream politics. Jumana Haddad is a writer, journalist, activist, and one-time parliamentary candidate in Lebanon. In all these activities, she tackles political subjects head-on with a clear idea that she thinks we can all make the world a better place. Jumana features in a documentary scheduled to be released this year entitled Diaries from Lebanon, that documents her journey from parliamentary candidate to activist. But she's also seen the ugly side of that commitment to a political life. She's faced campaigns to have her writing banned and had threats of violence made against her. Nevertheless, she said, "We need to be involved in the world around us. Trying to make it just a little bit better by influencing just our direct circle is a duty, not just a choice. It's important for us to feel outrage whenever we see an injustice." Jumana Haddad, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much, Faisal.
Let's start by following up on that quote of yours. You know, just across the border from where you are in Lebanon, over 30,000 people have been killed in Israel's war in Gaza. This border conflict in your own country between Israel and Hezbollah has been grinding away, leaving hundreds dead, including dozens of civilians. You mention outrage at injustice. You must be feeling a lot of outrage right now.
A lot. And it's, you know, it's increasing day after day. You know, Faisal, the last 4 years haven't been easy on us in Lebanon, from the, you know, the revolution that we had in 2019, and then the economic breakdown of the country, and then the port explosion, and now what's happening in Gaza. I mean, I always feel like things are getting worse instead of getting better. And this is what's making me even more outraged. Sometimes people ask me, when will you stop being angry? And I think I will die angry.
Mm. Do you think you will die angry because the situation in the region is unlikely to change in that timescale?
At one point, I used to believe that it was going to change. Unfortunately, at least now, at this stage of my life, I feel like it's a dead end situation, unfortunately, because the criminals are getting stronger and meaner by the minute, and us, you know, the people, are getting more and more denied our basic rights, what makes us human beings. You know, we are denied that. So I don't think that we are heading towards the end of the tunnel. We are stuck inside the tunnel, and I don't see an end to this tunnel. I know it sounds quite pessimistic, but this is how it is. From where I'm standing.
Yeah, so that's what I was going to ask you actually about the pessimism, because if you call it pessimism, because some people might call it realism. But I mean, I wonder if you feel that, is it difficult to kind of hold on to a political life at the very same time as you feel that things are actively getting worse?
Well, I guess it all depends on what we mean by politics and how we look at politics. Is politics only, you know, like running for parliament or having a position in the government, et cetera, et cetera? If that's politics for you, then no, I don't think that's where change is going to come. But politics for me is much more than that. It's even in the way we live our daily lives. You know, in your intro, you spoke about this small circle. any change that we manage to produce in this small circle of ours is a political act. Refusing to, you know, like the way I and many others have done, to just abandon this land, abandon this region. And I'm not blaming those who left. I understand them completely. But staying here, despite all the frustration, all the fear, all the violence, all the despair, that's also a political act. Trying to change the youth's view on the values that make us good citizens, that's also a political act. And that's where I try to have a small input through my work and my activism.
I noticed that when you talk about the situation in Lebanon today, you're always very careful to say that you don't judge the people who have left. And I wonder if that's because there is such a push for people to leave Lebanon because it is so, you know, difficult at various points. And I wonder if that's a big part of the internal Lebanese conversation about whether to stay, whether to go.
I mean, it's always been like that. Ever since I was a child growing up during the Civil War, this push-pull to stay or leave has always been there. And let me tell you that everything pushes us to leave. Nothing encourages us to stay, but we stay nonetheless. And yes, it is a big conversation and it is a big suffering as well, because I know so many families have been dismantled, especially during the last couple of years because of what's been happening in Lebanon. Many of, like, for example, I have a center called a Freedom Center for young people to, you know, instill values of freedom of expression and equality and secularism in them. And I can tell you that maybe more than 75% of our members have left the country. The young especially are leaving the country. It's like we are bleeding our young.
Yeah. And how do you feel about this phrase? We had the Lebanese journalist Dalal Mu'awad on the podcast recently, and she told us that she really rejects this notion of Lebanese resilience. She was saying that convincing ourselves that we are resilient is actually counterproductive. I wonder how you feel about that, about this idea of the Lebanese, because Lebanese resilience is often glorified in some way.
I know. It's like, I mean, I don't reject it because it's somehow true, but I resent it. And there's a difference between the two notions. Sometimes people ask me, what's this Lebanese secret? Is it the fact that we've been trained through decades of hardship to quickly get back on our feet and recover after each blow? I'm convinced it's much more than that. It's not just resilience. It's like a defiant stance, a big no in the face of everything that keeps trying to dishearten us, scare us, murder us, tell us that there's no solution and that we are not worthy of living. So we are resilient, and it does have a positive connotation, but it also, like just like Dalal said, has a negative impact on some of us, because sometimes while we are trying to survive and seize the moment, because who knows what's going to happen tomorrow, we forget to live, we forget to fight, we forget that there's something more than just this minute or the minute after, that we need to build a real future, a deserving country, a country that respects us and that we respect.
I think it's fair to say that in your work and in your life, in a more general sense, you've dealt throughout with what we might call the personal cost of politics. The personal cost of politics has been quite high for you, I think. Whether you're angry at the injustice of a political event that happened generations past, which we will come to, or you're dealing with personal threats against you for your current political opinions. So before we talk about your political opinions and about this political moment in Lebanon, I thought I'd ask you about your personal experiences. We'll get to to the book you've recently written, or the novel, but I wanted to ask you if you think that, is there a line for you between the personal and the political?
In my case, no, there's not. Actually, when you were asking me about the cost of being in politics, I was thinking to say that it's actually the cost of being myself, simply being myself. So this is how I am, whether in my daily life or in my public life. And there's never been a separation between the two. And obviously it's quite hard to live like that. It's hectic even. It's exhausting. It's overwhelming. But just being who you are in a country and in a culture and in a region that always tries to, transform you into something else, into something that conforms to the main current, to the standards that are there, to the religious views that are existing in this area. It's also very political. Just saying, this is how I am, this is how I think, this is what I want to say, this is how I want to live my life. And you don't have the right to tell me that I shouldn't be here. I should be here as much as you have the right to be here. And that's also quite political, in my opinion.
Do you find yourself sometimes thinking that you seem to be permanently at odds with parts of the Lebanese experience? I ask this because, you know, you and I have known each other now quite a few years, and I think in many respects, for a certain generation of observers of Lebanon and Lebanese, we look at you and we think that you embody a certain type of Lebanon. But then sometimes when I talk to you, I wonder if you do seem to have so much rebellion in you about where the state of Lebanon is. And I wonder if that is an internal thing, or whether it's the outside world, it's everybody else. They're just permanently trying to change you from the person you are at your core.
Well, maybe it's both. I mean, I've always been a rebel, and it's sometimes I wonder, you know, I wonder, Faisal, if had I been born in a country, for example, like Sweden, where I shouldn't have to fight to be respected as a human being, where I shouldn't have to strive in order to get what is duly mine. Would I have been different? Would I have been this rebellious? No. I don't know. But I do believe that just saying no to everything that tries to transform you into something you're not is an essential part of being alive. Sometimes you're just, you go with the flow. I've never been able to go with the flow. And unfortunately, the flow isn't going in the direction where I want to go and the direction where I would like my life to go. So I just have to keep struggling and keep fighting. I feel like conflict is my flesh and blood. It's like such a huge part it's been, and it still is such a huge part of my identity, of the way I view this world, that it's an intrinsic part of me. Now, am I tired? Would I love to live, at least for a short period of time, a life of serenity? Definitely. But am I able to do that after 50 years of, you know, fighting and struggling and refusing to submit? I doubt that.
Do you think that you've never had opportunities for that? Because, I mean, it seems to me that there must have been periods of your life where you could have had what you might think of as a slightly easier journey, even for a period of time. Do you not think perhaps you chose those moments?
Yeah, it would have been like that. And yes, it would have been possible if I had taken the choice of or the decision to, like, for example, live abroad. And I could have done that, and I still can do that. So this conflict that I'm talking about, it is also a choice, not just a destiny. I'm choosing this, and I'm choosing this because somehow, and call me naive or whatever, I'm convinced that even though I'm fiercely criticized or fought or unaccepted, there are people in this part of the world who need people like me. And we are not a few. There are lots of us who are deciding to stay because change really does happen from within. It cannot be imported. And even if I went to live in France, because like I'm also French and I could go and live in Paris, for example, even if I lived there, would I be serene? No, because I would be completely immersed in what's happening here. And I would be unable to cut the umbilical cord with Lebanon. I mean, this is how I've always been. I leave, but I need to come back. This is where I belong. And this is where I demand my right to live and belong. I don't want to be pushed out. I refuse to be pushed out.
You know, Lebanon is a fascinating country in so many ways. One of the reasons it's so fascinating is that I think people are incredibly patriotic towards it in the way that you find Palestinians are and Egyptians are. And I find that one of the parts of it that I find so interesting is that the Lebanese also, in a way that a lot of other Arab countries don't, they kind of hold the idea of Lebanon with them, even when they go abroad or they go elsewhere. We were talking with one of our colleagues who is Palestinian about the necessity that the Palestinians have for carrying the idea of Palestine with them, even when they are elsewhere. And I sometimes wonder if that experience is also a Lebanese experience, that somehow carrying with you the idea of Lebanon, the reality of Lebanon, the problems of Lebanon, is something that a kind of Lebanese feel they need to do.
Well, let me tell you, patriotism is a tricky notion, especially in Lebanon. Now, I understand maybe those who leave do carry the country with them, and that's when maybe they start being patriotic. But in Lebanon, it's not really patriotism. And I'm not quite sure if I like the notion or agree with the notion of patriotism anyway. It's more, unfortunately, a sense of belonging to your religion or your sect. I wish we had more people saying, I am Lebanese, before saying, I am a Maronite, or I am a Shia, or I am a Sunni. Unfortunately, despite a very vicious civil war from 1975 till 1990, and all the horrible events that came after that, all the assassinations, all the bombings, etc., etc., people are still very attached or defined by their sect. And this is not something spontaneous or innate. It's something that is instilled in them by the different political parties and leaders in order to be able to rule. You know this saying, in order to rule, you need to divide. We have it in Arabic. So people are divided by their superficial difference, which is their faith, in order to stay afraid of each other and not become a people, basically.
But I mean, you've interpreted the term patriotic to mean a kind of loyalty to the state, which I understand that's normally what it does mean. But I kind of mean it in a sense of loyalty to an idea of being Lebanese, depending on what that conception is. Because one thing that I think is so intriguing, like if you talk to, you're right, of course, there's, you know, the divisions between the various religions and the sects. But if you talk to Lebanese abroad and in Lebanon, they always say they are Lebanese. Something about the conception of them as Lebanese is more important than even the idea of what the current state looks like.
Yeah. I mean, there is some kind of pride in being Lebanese, even though sometimes it borders the cliches, you know, being able to ski in the morning and then swim in the afternoon, the nightlife, etc., etc. We are all that, but that's not what we are. We are not just the tabbouleh and the good times and the ability to create joy from nothing. We are also people who are not managing to live with each other. And we need to always remember that in order to heal, because if we don't admit the problem, we will never be able to move forward. And this is a big problem. We always talk about, you know, the miracle of living together in Lebanon despite all the differences. And this is what's making us unable to unite, because we keep stressing on all the differences that we have instead of stressing on what brings us together. And this is one of the reasons why the revolution on October 17, 2019 failed to bring a real change in the country, unfortunately.
I suppose the next logical question is to ask what you think the Lebanese conception is. I knew there'd be a pause.
Yeah.
It's a hard question.
Yeah, because, you know, before I answer that, I need to, because I think a lot about this. Am I in the obvious sense Lebanese? I mean, I do belong to other lands and countries and cultures as well, in my heart as much as in my intellect. So is my need to stay here the result of me feeling that I am Lebanese, or is it a mixture of what this place brings me as far as family and friends and memories are concerned, as much as the fight that nourishes my need to make a change in this world and make it a better place? I mean, I'm quite unsure whether I deserve between brackets to call myself Lebanese or to say I am Lebanese first. I'd rather say I am a human being who lives in Lebanon, who loves this country, who was born here, who never left, who doesn't want to leave, and who claims her right to stay even if everything or most of the things around her are pushing her to leave and to let go and to say, that's it, this part of the world is not mine anymore. So is it obstination or belonging in the classical sense of belonging? Is it a mutual beneficial partnership, or is it a sense of belonging in the classical sense of belonging? Mm-hmm. I don't know. I'm still discovering that in myself.
I want to go back to the point you made about somehow the struggle being in the blood. You said that you are now the fourth generation woman in your family to experience a different conflict. But you've experienced conflict personally, perhaps throughout your living memory. You were born in the 70s, when just before the Lebanese Civil War broke out.
Yeah.
How do you think that period of your life, and of course the Lebanon War was there throughout your adolescence, how do you think that period affected you?
Oh, it definitely made me who I am. A big part of that. I mean, I always talk about two major elements that have, or two major fires that have forged me. One of them is books and literature. They have, to a large extent, made me the person that I am today. And the second part is the fire of war and conflict and fear that I had to grow up with and deal with since a very young age. So it's war changes you. It doesn't necessarily makes you a tougher person or a better person or a worse person, but it is a training on on the art of dying. I've always thought about death ever since I can remember. And it's not easy to live while thinking you can die any minute. And I think many Lebanese, this is how they live their lives. And I tried to fight that instinct in me, because it became an instinct. It's not, it's a reflex. It's like, let me do whatever I can do. I have this fear of missing out on whatever I can do today. And maybe this is why I've always been an overachiever. Because who knows if I'm going to be here tomorrow. And it makes you a different kind of person. A fighter, yes, but also someone who doesn't know how to enjoy life properly. I'm not saying this out of sadness. I'm not complaining. I love the way I've been molded. I know how, at the same time, sensitive and tender I am, and how tough and strong I am. And I love that. And this is part of my journey and what I've been through growing up in this country. But also, like I said earlier, sometimes I just feel exhausted, Faisal. Sometimes I just want to wake up and not feel the need to go to war, because this is how I wake up. And I know that many others are like me. We wake up and we say, okay, let's go to war, because there's no big war, but there are so many small wars happening in our lives day after day, minute after minute. And we need to be for it, and we need to be up for the challenge and confront our demons and make things happen despite all the obstacles that we are facing.
Well, let's talk a little bit about some of your political views and some of the political fights you have waded into. You chose in 2008 to take on an intensely political topic when you founded Jasad, which is a quarterly magazine dedicated to the body, which is what it means in Arabic. It contained a mixture of reporting about topics such as forced marriage and virginity, and also provided a platform for erotic fiction. Now, unsurprisingly, it proved controversial from the very beginning in Lebanon, and you've described receiving death threats and other threats of violence. Did that very real threat against you as a person impact the way you thought about or practiced your work?
Not at all. I can proudly say not at all, because, you know, I've been trained to understand that I'm not someone who can blend in this culture and in this region. And I've been trained to accept that and to even feel proud about that. So when I started publishing Jasad, I already knew that I was going to, you know, get a lot of threats and attacks and insults. And I didn't allow that to intimidate me. It's part of my, insistence on writing whatever I want to write, saying whatever I want to say, living the way I want to live, and considering all that as my basic fundamental right as a human being, as long as I'm not hurting other people.
Why specifically that topic, though, which you know is an explosively political topic in Lebanon?
Because we are still scared until now. I mean, that was 2009. That was 15 years ago. Can you imagine that even now I just started a podcast discussing these same topics? It's as if we go one step forward and 10 steps backwards. And it's unnerving, it's frustrating. We need to discuss this. We need to liberate our bodies in order to liberate our minds and our souls and our actions before we start feeling convinced that our bodies are ours and ours alone. And here I'm talking obviously about women, but also about men, because men are also slaves of all the taboos that are widespread in this area. Before we do that, we cannot claim to be really free or emancipated or move towards a more enlightened society, which is something we should all be striving for and looking forward to and trying to make it happen. So it's an essential topic. It's obviously something that I've always been interested in. I've always been interested in erotica and the body as much as in all the gender violence that I was witnessing around me growing up, all the injustices that existed and still exist. So I decided to do the magazine because out of personal interest, but also out of political affirmation, because I thought this is something that we need to discuss.
I want to see if we can figure out where you sit in the Arab political tradition. You'll recall that we were talking about this just before we came on, that we did a literary salon together in Lebanon around that time, part of this series of salons I was doing at the time in Beirut and Damascus and elsewhere. But one of the ideas that came up again and again during those salons was this idea of the secular and liberal Arab tradition, which I think you very much embody. Do you feel that well, first of all, what would you call it? Would you call it the liberal Arab tradition, the secular Arab tradition?
Liberal and secular, just like you said.
Okay. And at the time, it felt to me like that was something that was quite common among a large part of the Arab youth, let's say. And particularly, of course, some of the older people who'd been around in the 50s and 60s. I wonder if you think, in the 15 years since, things have changed in Lebanon. I mean, do you think that liberal Arab tradition still exists to the degree it used to?
Yes, it does exist. But I wouldn't say even then that it constituted a large part of Arab societies. I mean, sometimes because we surround ourselves with people who usually think like us, people who belong to the same planet, this is how I call them, who view life the way we view it, who consider freedom a basic right, a basic human right, who think that equality should be obvious, and that freedom of expression and freedom of thought and freedom of belief are things that are given and not things that we should fight for. These people that surround us make us sometimes extrapolate and think that there are many people who are like that in our countries or our cultures. I have discovered since that we are a minority and we are still a minority. Because if you go deep into the country, and even if you scratch a little bit in some of those outwardly liberal, secular people, if you scratch their surface, then the zealot, traditional, conservative, macho monster will come out again.
And do you think that it's because there isn't, or you say there isn't a wide enough group of people who believe that, do you think that that is why a political tradition didn't reassert itself during the Arab Spring?
I do think so. Because when you are forced to choose between a military monster and a religious monster, I mean, there's no way out from the pit or the abyss where you are stuck. You are still going to be there. And Since there's no viable, I mean, I'm sure there are secular, liberal currents and figures out there in the Arab world, and they are amazing and they're doing great work. But since there's no viable, such viable option, and by viable, I mean something that has a big following, that has the means to exist and prove itself and lead and govern, then we will still stay stuck between the religious monster and the military monster. And it can have many faces, it can have many masks, but this is how it is.
Do you think, though, that the fact that so few Arabs, when they have had the opportunity to agitate for that particular worldview, have not taken the opportunity, do you not think that that is indicative of the fact that not that many people want it?
Yeah, I'm sure that not many people want it. And I'm sure that it's still not the right time. And it breaks my heart. Honestly, it breaks my heart. Because when I look in the eyes of those who tried and fought and took to the streets and believed in the change, whether in the Arab world, whether in Egypt or Tunisia or wherever, or in Lebanon, I cannot but feel heartbroken, because we really believed in that potential, different, evolved version of our societies. But we are still not ready for that, because not enough people want it. Not enough people.
But don't you think, this is a hard question to ask, I understand, but don't you think that if not enough people want the liberal Arab tradition, do you not think that is because the liberal Arab tradition has not provided sufficient solutions for the political moment?
It's a part of the answer, but it's not all the answer. Let's not also neglect or ignore the international interference in all those dynamics. We are not truly those who fully decide what's going to happen to us and what's going to happen in our countries. Were we like that, like, for example, in Lebanon, we would have been able to make it happen. But there are so many, I'm not talking about a conspiracy theory here, Faisal, but there are so many power dynamics and international interests at play that at the end of the day, if you manage to move a small rock from its place, you've done a lot. It's a miracle, because so many things are decided for you. And it's, can you imagine someone who believes in freedom and who is at the same time aware of how much of this freedom is decided by external powers and not by your own will? Can you imagine how frustrating that is? But this is the truth. I mean, we cannot ignore the fact that money runs the world, financial interests run the world, external powers are playing chess in this part of the world, and there's a lot at stake.
You haven't shied away from controversial or difficult topics, and you've attacked and criticized Islam as much as you have Christianity, which is the religion you were born into, although you no longer subscribe to any faith, I think. You've previously said that there is a form of colonial feminism that I truly despise. Those who consider that in the name of cultural relativism, we need to accept that a woman can wear the niqab or a man should have four wives. I interviewed the French journalist Nabila Ramdani, and she has a rather different view. She's described the French so-called burqa ban as a hateful assault on basic freedoms. So I wonder where you sit along that continuum now. Do you still, do you disagree with that perspective on the burqa?
Oh, I disagree with Nabila's view, and I stand by even more firmly by what I have written and said on the subject. I do believe that, there's no such thing as accepting the burqa in the name of respect for people's beliefs, because the burqa is in itself an imposition, and respecting an imposition is not a form you cannot respect an imposition and say at the same time that you are respecting people's freedom. I know that many women say that they have chosen to wear the burqa, but choice demands many factors. It demands awareness. It demands a proper and viable alternative in case you don't want to wear the burqa instead of being persecuted or ostracized or whatever. It demands not being fed and brainwashed ever since you are 4 or 5 or 6 on the fact that you are a mere temptation and you need to cover yourself up in order to not tempt the men around you, which is quite insulting to men, honestly. So yes, I still believe that in the name of cultural relativism, sometimes leftist European and American feminists are condoning things that are abominable.
That would put you very much in the Arab feminist tradition of people like Nawal al-Saadawi, who also would have said that you need to stop people wearing this because they cannot truly choose it. But I guess that Ramdani would say that your criticism of the hijab, the niqab, is actually antithetical to so much of what you've dedicated your life to, namely giving women the agency to choose what they do with their own bodies.
Again, you're using the word choose, and I have a problem with that. I have a big problem with that. Because, I mean, and let me be clear, as much as I consider the burqa an imposition and a form of discrimination and even oppression. The burqa is so oppressive. As much as I consider the porn culture, for example, and the fact that so many women treat their bodies as mere pieces of meat, also a result of brainwashing. They might sound different, but it's one and the same, as if the woman only exists as an object, something to look or not look at. And it's at this level, it also reminds me of another analogy, because sometimes, for example, people in the West make a clear cut between the right-wing people who are Islamophobic and those who are attached to their, not only attached, but also zealous in their beliefs and sometimes even extremists. I do believe that both extremisms feed each other, and they need each other. And we need to find a third way to exist as women, as human beings, without the need to feel like we are looked at all the time. So we need to hide or we need to expose.
I wonder if part, we were talking about the Arab liberal tradition, I wonder if part of the reason why the Arab liberal tradition is falling out of favor, having once been in favor and then fallen out, I wonder if that's partly because of a shift in the idea of what these symbols represent. And I think that's the difference perhaps between you and Ramdani, that for you, you see it as a representation of a particular way of seeing the world, an oppressive way in your telling. But I think that Ramdani would say that actually you're trying to allow people opportunities to choose whatever it is they prefer, whether that is, as we were saying earlier, pornography or, for example, the burqa. And that setup, that way of choosing, is something that is very in keeping with the capitalist creation of the world now. And I wonder if that is the reason why the liberal tradition is kind of moving to the sidelines, because it doesn't have answers for the political moment now.
Yeah, and trust me, once we are truly able to choose whether to walk naked on the street just because we want to, or walk in a burqa, then I would, consider that as something that needs to be totally respected. But still, we are not choosing. And like you said, it's because the liberal Arab tradition hasn't introduced a viable way to, make Islam and liberalism compatible. I do believe that's one of the main problems. But also, another problem is that people, I'm noticing, are becoming more and more religious out of anger and frustration and disappointments. And it's because the governments, I mean, most of the governments, are corrupt, are selfish, are self-centered, are criminals and robbers, and are not truly governing the countries like the countries should be governed. So this is how you find a place to run away to. And that place for many people has been Islam.
In 2015, you met with the late TV chef Anthony Bourdain on his series Parts Unknown. He asked you if he was wrong to love Beirut despite its flaws, to which you replied, "I love living on the tip of a volcano, but there has to be some point where I could breathe and relax." Nearly a decade later, you're still here. So can we take it from that that you're committed to your life on the tip of the volcano?
Yeah, not only committed, I would say addicted. I don't know if it's a collateral damage of being born here and growing up here and living the life that I have lived. I don't want to praise, hardship. It's not that. But I am addicted to this particular volcano. I love my life here, despite all the challenges and the struggles. And I would love to be able to breathe one day from here and think, well, the volcano is giving me a small break, and then it will wake up again, and that would be fine. But I don't want to breathe abroad. This is where I want to breathe.
Jumana Haddad, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
This has been The Lead, the New Lines Magazine podcast. You can find Jumana on Twitter at jhaddadofficial. Her books have been widely translated and can be found at all good bookstores and online. This week's episode was produced by Finbar Anderson and hosted by me, Faizal Yafai. For more like this, subscribe to The Lead on your favorite podcast app or visit our website, newlinesmag.com. Join us again next week.